I'm going to, first of all, thank you very much for inviting me. I'm Shannon Slagger from the University of Essex. It says that there. I'm going to talk rather more generally, a little bit beyond Tony's specific comments on voting and largely on London. And I'm going to take sort of a UK perspective, but you'll see I'll come back to the sort of voting point halfway through. And the other preliminary point I'd like to raise at the beginning would be to say that I suppose, listening in and participating in this morning's discussion, there was a kind of theme developing around, I think John put it best, around the kind of economic lens one would use as opposed to, I guess, non-economic lenses. I mean, I would obviously emphasise the political one, other people would say cultural and what have you. And it seems to me that most in the room would sort of nod in response to having heard that. The real prize would be to sort of try to pick insights from both those lenses and develop a kind of third added value lens. But anyhow, this is a kind of map and compass of what I want to cover. But I want to add yet another lens just before we get going. And I think, frankly, I'm making the point that history matters. Anyone who's studied great cities like London will tell you that you get a kind of feel for the ebb and flow of sort of good times, bad times, new groups, old groups. But actually, one of the things you get when you take a look at Bill Fishman's quite legendary work is, this is what I took away from it, it's the sense in which, as the story of cities such as London is told, there are kind of reputations in the ascendancy and reputations in the descendancy. Or put another way, today's pariah sometimes can become tomorrow's paragons. As a personal note, I wasn't going to say that, but when my family washed up here 40-odd years ago, I think it's safe to say that we were both guilty of raising and lowering house prices at the same time, of marrying their women and marrying our own kind, and you see where I'm going with this, okay? And I'm, at the very least, I was left sort of scratching my head. I mean, am I a paragon, am I a pariah? Maybe one into the other. Hopefully not pariah, paragon into pariah, it should be the other way around. Anyhow, there's a lovely book written in the United States by sociologist from UCLA who sort of makes this point about US migration history, and the book is in fact called From Pariahs to Paragons, and I think that's my only point there. General observations, and this kind of draws out some of the themes that we were talking about directly and indirectly earlier on. I won't sort of dwell upon all of them in great detail, but some do stand out. The first is, and I think it's slightly picked up in Tony's comments, the striking thing is that as a country and also as a city, we are essentially normalising our migration. And by that I mean, the story of migration to this country, as well indeed the city, in the mid-20th century point, when we washed up, oh God.
Just no, answer.
Just click on the cross, yeah.
On the cross.
Yeah, go away. That's mine.
Mid-20th century, migration to this country was skewed towards the former Commonwealth. It was a byproduct of decolonisation. For that reason, we have lots of South Asians and Caribbeans. Whereas by now, by contrast, we have much more of a kind of cross-section of whoever in the world is mobile and seeks to make their future, rightly or wrongly, in a large, complex, cosmopolitan place such as London. And in making that point, I think there is at least the potential of there being a kind of misalignment or maybe even stronger de-alignment with national political priorities around, not just migration, but a whole bunch of things to do with economics and social welfare. I mean, that's been sort of kicking around the edges so far. Last general observation, quite important, and I think it's sort of self-evident. There is an inherent mistake in people interested in migration, let's call them migration specialists for a moment, gathering together and sort of banging on about migration. That's to say, you tend to sort of miss other things that we also know, so we need to combine these lenses. And let me just list a couple of them just to make the point. Political scientists and others, through public attitudes research, have made quite a lot about the fact, as a society, we're just less keen on aspects of collectivism. Individualism, particularly amongst younger generations, is a more pronounced feature of our public attitudes than it was some time ago. Point one. Now, with that in mind, you need to sort of use that lens to sort of apply it to how we feel about others who are either like us or not like us. And yet another example would be this question that popped up earlier on, which is we have this extraordinary story of London school success in the last 10 or 12 year period. But it's not entirely clear whether or not that is a kind of a compositional issue. In other words, it's the migrants within that story, because London's been filling up with more migrants in this period. In other words, have they done the heavy lifting, which is one interpretation, and that will sort of take you to aspects of the educational values and ethos, versus, and it could be both incidentally, versus the effects of different policy interventions, and that's had an effect across the board and lifted all boats at the same time. There's a report this morning published on the BBC website which encourages you to take the latter view. In other words, it's not group specific, it's to do with policy, and groups have benefited disproportionately. So it's just it just makes the point that you just don't need a migration lens to look at these things. Mm-hmm. So history matters. I think we sort of had mass migration in this fit of absent-mindedness. That's a paraphrase from Duncan Sandys, who was a colonial office minister in the early 1960s. But I think the middle part of this is what I'd like to dwell upon. I think what I've tried to do is summarise quite a lot of the issues that have been cropping up so far. And it seems to me we have got fault lines around sort of four, maybe five elements at the bottom. And the first is quite straightforward. It's often presented as being an issue of scale or quantum. Too many, too few. To which I think, actually, probably what we mean, and this was apparent earlier on, is sort of, you know, scale divided by time. In other words, rate. Mm. What we're really talking about are either at a London level or sometimes even sort of a borough or neighbourhood level, the evidence that demonstrates there is a kind of absorptive capacity from one place to another, from one time to another. And if it is the case that we've had the largest peacetime movement of people from Eastern Europe into the UK, disproportionately to London and similar kind cities, which have had a labour market demand like no others, then probably the rate issue does come into it. So it's not about queues of people, that's actually my family, queues of people trying to get into this country in response to the East African Kenyan crisis of 1968. It's much more about the demand for labour at any one time, and what goes with that will vary, but also can vary in different parts of London. That's my house being reconstructed by remote Romanian workers 5 years ago, so there's a bit of a contrast. Yeah, let me move on. Composition is our second element of argument. There's a kind of politically correct way of describing composition, which essentially refers to human capital. What's the right sort of mix between high, low-skilled? Do we have controls over those? Can we influence in any great degree of detail? Quite tricky. But of course, in the old days, composition and selectivity meant not that. It meant people like us. The Royal Commission on Population in 1949 has a very interesting paragraph in it, and if I summarise, it essentially talks about being in favour of post-war migration for economic reconstruction, comma, but so long as the migrant populations would not be prevented for reasons to do with culture, kinship, religion, a couple of other things they go on to mention, from intermarrying with the host population. They're just not like us. That was a concern. So that's a very different way of sort of saying they are more or less skilled. I mean, clearly this is much more to do with who they are rather than what they can do. You make, you know, pay your money, take your choice on that. Thirdly, we've talked a lot about congestion effects, don't need to dwell upon that. And fourthly, which is my area of research and sort of contribution, which is the view I've ended up taking on this, is to say, although there are arguments about these other three things, actually quite a large, on polling evidence, a large part of this seems to suggest that governments in general tend to overpromise and underdeliver. The public have become mistrustful of this. They've hollowed out most promises. In fact, they discount from promises made on lots of issues, not just migration, particularly on, you know, and they look at this through the lens of what you may want to call competence, the basket of indicators that encourage me to vote for one team versus another. And that basket is made up not just of migration and borders, but it's also made up of things such as NHS waiting lists, school attainment, management of the macroeconomy are all good examples of competence measures that voters are invited to sort of, as it were, take a view on. So I, in a sense, stripping out the essential element of this, saying it's a bit like other issues in that respect. Last aspect of the political fault line, I'm sorry, it's just sort of got tucked in at the bottom, is what I call the Pierre Trudeau test. You can see the quote he has here. Simply made the point that the state should not have any business in the bedrooms of the people. What does he mean by that? Well, actually, it's odd that migration does take us into that very private realm. It's not so long ago the Labour government in the 1970s, and to some extent even the Conservative government in the early 1980s, got itself into trouble. Or did it get itself into trouble? Because its mechanism of delivering against promises in response to anxiety would have civil servants, public officials, conduct virginity tests at Heathrow Airport. That's clearly breaching the Pierre Trudeau test. We didn't think it at the time, but if we took that kind of approach today, we'd be quite alarmed. I don't think we would take this approach. But I think this is the kind of recipe that causes political tension, and if I may say so, memories and a bit of grievance from the past. Geography and demography is fairly straightforward. We talk about winners and losers. I've tried to oversimplify. What I'm making here is that, and something was said about Indians and their potential propensity to sort of drift rightwards, the point I'd make is that there's disproportionately a London population. They are to some extent found in the Midlands as well, but not at all in the northern mill towns. Why is that important? Because their close cousins, the Pakistanis, have had the, as it were, misfortune of coming to this country at about the same time and disproportionately not concentrating in London and finding themselves what turned out to be all at sea in the former northern mill towns, many of whose industrial bases collapsed. So for that secular trend not to do with them, they have, as it were, become more fragile in our labour market, like their white counterparts, incidentally. But by contrast, being in London or gathering in London then or now has raised your overall odds of there being some demand for your labour. The proximity to London labour market speaks for itself. Indian and Chinese, that's true. Of Bangladeshis can go either way. The figures until 12 years ago, now it's spreading out a bit, were 9 in 10 Bangladeshis were a London-based population. It's a good thing, as compared with being a Pakistani, that where very few of them. And the Caribbeans, I think, also slightly skewed towards London and the Midlands, but where the evidence is much more mixed. So there's a kind of geographic aspect to this, I think, that needs to be brought into account. And what we're really asking ourselves is, what are the great sort of engines of growth and job creation? And then mapping that onto the groups who find their way to the UK in the past, the present, and indeed the future. The interesting group, again, sorry, the slides have gone a bit odd, are the Polish migrants. There's a piece coming out in Demos Quarterly that I've done with a group of colleagues at Essex, which talks about, you can't quite read it, but those words at the bottom say, frictionless migration. And it's trying to allude to their story and the evidence we've collected in the four-country cross-national survey to make the point that actually, you know, are we, well, the question is, do we see the same sort of friction that we have in response to them? Because after all, they're very different from the migration of the mid-20th century, when oftentimes a peasantry from rural India made their way to a rich European country on a one-way basis, whereas the average Polish migrant doesn't look like that at all. They have all sorts of patterns of circularity and return migration and connection with their home country. Electoral dynamics, Tony said quite a lot. I'm not going to dwell upon it. Same report, funny enough, we didn't confirm. But I would just, it boils down to what I've, in the past, an earlier book I wrote called, I described it the iron law of minority voting behaviour, which is to say, for all elections going back to October 74, when we first started studying this through the British Election Study and some other surveys, for our all minority voters, by which we mean in this country black or brown, South Asian or Caribbean origin, but 4 out of 5 who register and vote, so subject to those adjustments, vote for the Labour Party. It's a bit like saying they don't vote for anyone else. And it's very high. And what's interesting about it, when you do it over a 40-year period, is it just gets stuck at about that 80%. In other words, it's true in Labour's wilderness years, in the 1980s, when no one was voting for Labour, or at least very few were, but the minorities were, of course, voting in very large numbers. You could describe them as being hyper-loyal and put any kind of spin on that. It's also true when people were deserting the Labour Party in fairly significant terms up to the 2010 election. So it's a curious group. Having said that, it may look like ethnicity is trumping class. Class has always been that kind of alternative prism through which we see and try to explain a fair bit of British electoral behaviour, even to this day. But what I would point out is when Tony Heath and I did the first minority booster survey in the 1997 election, we did actually find there to be a class effect even within the minority voting patterns. That's to say, though their class didn't vary very much, but where it varied at all, it was associated with the loosening of their Labour moorings. So I'm not at all surprised, spin forward half a generation later on, that we see some of this. In fact, you would have said it's much delayed. You would have expected it earlier on. I won't dwell upon this because, I mean, that's somewhat covered already. But what I would spend a bit of time on is this last sort of penultimate slide. What I've described here are sort of 5 points that I think sort of summarise where the policy challenges have been where they are now and where they will continue to be. And you'll notice the lion's share of these that overwhelmingly are skewed to things that are essentially mostly not about the economic impacts. It's odd that on the one hand we spend a lot of time collecting the information, the data, going over it, trying to interpret it, and yet the political issues and public policy challenges lie in a much broader array of challenges. Well, the first is, sorry, it's a bit of jargon, I call it public policy sensitization. What I mean by that? Well, what I mean is that if you look back and you look at the way in which we do policy in this country, in education, in healthcare, in welfare, and so on and so forth, there has been some degree of adjustment or sensitization to the needs of different citizens. I mean, it is the case in this country, empirically, factually, that we're in the business of providing, through state education and state prisons, incidentally, halal food for those who want halal food. I mean, we do it. It's something that, for better or for worse, we got in the habit of doing that 20 or 30 years ago. So the first challenge, in a sense, would be to say how much sensitization would be appropriate before there is the risk of a backlash and a ethnic majority, or indeed other ethnic minorities themselves, complaining of there being a carve-out, that groups have got special rights and special privileges, which began with sensitization but looks really like an excuse for living alone, self-segregation, and that kind of that's kind of description. I don't know the answer to that, but I think we are in the sensitization game, and we can't get out of it anytime soon. It's a balancing act. Secondly, disproportionality is a bit of jargon, but again, it refers to sector after sector, industry after industry, example after example, where essentially you have the same problem occurring. That is to say that the minority communities, past migrants, current, and to some extent even future ones, as it were, or the ones that are present now, are reporting, as it were, outcomes in labour markets, in criminal justice, in education, and so on and so forth, which are not the same as their white ethnic majorities. Now, some of us would say that, of course, that's transitional, you have to sort of take a sort of 20-30 year lens to this, but nevertheless, these disproportionalities stand out time and time again. They stand out in stop and search arrests on the streets of London. It's not my view, that's Home Secretary's view, which will convince you that we need to make interventions to stop that happening. They stand out in, well, in my another incarnation, I'm a legal services regulator, so we disproportionately, at the Solicitors Regulation Authority, we disproportionately investigate small solicitors' firms that are disproportionately themselves minority-owned and or run. So there's an allegation in the industry that our case officers, our investigators, are unintentionally, subconsciously biased and prejudiced. So there's a disproportionality, there's a backlash against that. You'll also find that the same thing true with the doctors, the ones who get referred to the GMC, are disproportionately likely to be minorities. And again, the same thing comes up time and time again. Whilst I've got the thought that we slightly indulge the point, you can make a big deal about disproportionalities in relation to these things. It also seems to me you can extend it to other more sensitive areas. It is the allegation that, in particular, that younger and older Pakistani men are disproportionately involved in sexual abuse in parts of our country. That's an example of disproportionality. If it was just the same as everyone else, it seems to me that you'd have less of a story, less of a concern. In other words, are we is perversity, as it were, sexual perversity, disproportionately found in different parts of our country? I've got the time warning. Ethnic penalties, I would skip over. Here, I think there are real challenges. There's a link between these. I must read out the bottom. It's got slightly lost. These are the left-behind groups who can be characterized by anger, grievance, and even extremism. Of course, there's a picture of the 7-7 gang getting on a train in Luton several years ago. I could have many other pictures. But it seems to me you can link this other challenge of settled disadvantage. When you have concentrations of poverty and concentrations of lack of opportunity, and you overlay that with concentrations of ethnicity, it does seem to me that that is a good example of a legitimate public policy challenge. Why is it important? Well, it's important because of other expression, the theory of immigrant succession. It's a piece of social science jargon. It simply means that the reason why migrants in the past, now, and probably in the future will come, the one thing that more or less seems to unite all these different groups is the idea that they will come to a country such as the United Kingdom. The first generation may well put up with all sorts of hardship, including direct and indirect discrimination, but, and this is important, that they will do so on the basis of an implicit promise implicit that tomorrow will be a brighter day for their children. This theory of income succession is very heavily borrowed from the United States. And it requires there to be a regular replenishing, not just of faith, but of evidence. And evidence then that demonstrates that, in fact, these disproportionalities, good things and bad things, are slowly and, in some cases, you know, steadily going away. And immigrant succession, in other words, is essentially a promise, if you want, implicit, that that brighter day is available not just for the migrants, but also for the non-migrants that they've joined. If you disrupt that, you have, of course, a much bigger challenge in front of you, which is politely described as settled disadvantage, but of course can become a sort of a recipe for all sorts of other forms of what I would call grievance and grievance politics to go with it. I'll leave it there. Thank you.